due to transparency and the predictability of Iran's economy. Salman Kujuri, Tehran.
The Islamic Jihad movement held a national conference for women in the Gaza Strip on the occasion of International Women's Day. The conference, titled Woman is the Icon of Resistance, highlighted the role of Palestinian women in fighting the Israeli occupation and their struggle for freedom and justice. Palestinian women in the Gaza Strip paid a heavy toll during Israel's war on coastal enclave last year. According to human rights groups, the Israeli regime killed 60 women and 22 children in 2021.
We are supporting our women. We called the international, we addressed the international human rights to support our women, asking the international community to protect the women, to protect the children, to stop the occupation forces against the women in Palestine.
Addressing the conference through satellite transmission, Islamic Jihad Secretary General Dr. Ziad Nakhala praised the role of Palestinian women and their struggle against the Israeli regime for more than seven decades.
Palestinian women will not allow anyone to stop her resistance, consider it to be a red line. Palestinian women share military and political struggle with men. Palestinian women has given a lot for her homeland and abroad.
Conference attendees discussed ways of developing new strategies for women to confront the Israeli regime and its illegal practices, especially against women.
Palestinian women today meeting in Gaza to discuss about the role for women, for Palestinian women, and to discuss issues about how to defend the Palestinian in Palestine.
The annual event also tackled ways of bringing international attention to the plight of Palestinian women.
Palestinian women say that they will continue their struggle against the Israeli regime until the liberation of Al-Quds and all of Palestine. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
United States Secretary of State Antony Blinken wrapped up a visit to the leaders of six European nations, plus a visit with the European Union and Israel's foreign minister, with a closed-door meeting with French President Emmanuel Macron. Washington has just announced a ban on Russian fossil fuels, but Blinken has apparently not convinced the European Union to immediately sever energy ties with their primary supplier. Russia announced they would cut its oil supplies to Europe if they introduced energy sanctions, which would have a devastating economic impact, perhaps globally. In what many say is an effort to avoid peace and increase the likelihood of a major war, Blinken recently announced that NATO members can send fighter jets to Ukraine. The U.S. and Europe have already provided significant military aid to Ukraine and imposed sanctions so potentially sweeping that Russian Federation President Vladimir Putin recently said they were, quote, like a war.
France is not directly concerned in this conflict, and yet they've already overdone it. When their foreign minister declared an all-out economic and financial war against Russia, that is an act of war. However, there's no economic coherence here because Europe completely depends on Russia for gas, petrol, and titanium, while the loss of export sales to Russia would be a catastrophe for European agriculture.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky recently announced that he, quote, understood that NATO is not prepared to accept Ukraine, end quote, which appears to be a concession to one of Russia's primary demands to end its military operation. The risk of expanding the conflict is a major concern, and with Washington giving Russia a cold shoulder since their offensive, Macron has served as the West's primary mediator with Moscow.
Macron has failed in his mediations because he and Germany have not been able to convince Ukraine to respect the Minsk agreements. If Macron had been able to convince Ukraine of this, then things could have been quite different. France should have been able to achieve this, but the United States obviously didn't want it.
Since 2014, some 14,000 people have been killed in Ukraine. Russia's offensive on February 24th has produced almost 500 civilian deaths and nearly 2 million refugees, according to the United Nations. In recent years, many politicians have argued that the European Union is necessary in order to have peace on the continent. However, forming an EU army, sending arms within Europe, and waging a sanctions war, which is sure to hurt the Russian people, doesn't seem peaceful to many. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Members of Iran's Assembly of Experts have held their second biannual meeting this year. That's the ninth official session of the current assembly, which was elected in 2016.
Members of the Assembly of Experts convene twice a year to review the latest domestic and global issues. This time, Ebrahim Raisi, who's one of the Assembly's members, has participated as Iran's president.
Raisi was invited to highlight his administration's achievements and review the challenges it faces. During this session, Chairman of the Assembly of Experts, Ahmad Jannati, urged President Raisi to take practical steps to address the economic problems of Iranians and improve their livelihood.
We need to improve the livelihood of the less privileged strata. The Honorable President must take steps to make this happen. I hope other members of this cabinet follow suit and help the needy have a better life. This is the least we should do as a duty.
The Assembly of Experts was established in 1983, almost 4 years after the victory of the Islamic Revolution. Its main task is to monitor the performance of the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution. The experts should also elect a new leader in the event of the demise, resignation, or dismissal of the current leader.
The Assembly of Experts was the entity that elected Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei as the new leader after Imam Khomeini passed away in 1988. Not only does it supervise the performance of the leader, but it plays a crucial role in protecting the political establishment.
The Assembly of Experts is currently a body of 88 Islamic jurists. The entity consists of a leadership council and six committees. Members are elected by direct public vote for an 8-year term. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Palestinians rallied on Monday in front of the Red Cross office in Gaza to drum up support for thousands of prisoners held in Israeli jails. Their solidarity action comes as around 450 administrative detainees have been refusing to show up for their military court hearings for the third month in a row. Administrative detainees are denied due process, and their detention orders can be renewed for indefinite periods of time.
For the third month, the Palestinian administrative detainees are boycotting the Israeli military courts in order to protest the administrative detention. And now the Palestinian detainees need all kinds of support by the Palestinian community and the international community.
Palestinian prisoners are also subject to torture and psychological pressure by the Israeli prison authorities, including daily raids and solitary confinement. Currently, some 5,000 Palestinians are languishing inside Israeli jails, including minors and women.
The Israeli administration, they conducted series of attacks and aggression against prisoners, especially women. This gathering asking international community to put pressure to Israeli government in order to facilitate their rights and stop the aggression against Palestinian prisoners.
Palestinian prisoners regularly stage hunger strikes in protest against both the administrative detention policy and harsh detention conditions. Prisoners' advocacy groups have raised the alarm over the inhumane conditions inside Israeli jails.
Nowadays, the situation is going to explode inside Israeli prisons because of the Israeli measures that aimed to break the will of Palestinian detainees and to confiscate their rights.
Experts say Palestinian prisoners will continue to suffer inside Israeli jails as long as the international community keeps turning a blind eye to Tel Aviv's violations of their rights.
Statistics by human rights groups show that the Israeli regime has arrested over 1 million Palestinians since 1967. Ashraf Shana, Gaza.
Joint statement by the diplomatic missions of the Western countries in Islamabad has created an uproar in Pakistan. The statement posted on the social media platforms presses Pakistan to condemn Russia. The statement was signed by the envoys of European countries and endorsed by the U.S. Embassy in Islamabad. The move by the Western diplomatic missions here has drawn strong reaction from the Pakistani government. The Foreign Office has summoned the envoys of the Western countries to tell them that issuing public statements against the host country is not in line with the diplomatic protocols. On Sunday, Prime Minister Imran Khan doubled down on the European ambassadors and made it clear that Pakistan is not their slave.
I want to ask the European ambassadors, did you write such a letter to India? What do you think of us? Are we your slaves? That whatever you say, we will do.
Pakistan has maintained a fine balance in the ongoing conflict between Russia and the West over Ukraine. The reason Pakistan refused to condemn Russia stems from its growing ties with Moscow.
The only thing that I can say from Pakistan's government perspective that Pakistan wants de-escalation. Honestly, Pakistan wants end of the war or end of bombing or end of aggression anywhere for that matter in the world.
Pakistan has remained in the Western camp for decades, but now wants to diversify its foreign policy options. It was because of this reason that despite pressure from the West, Pakistan abstained from the voting on a resolution against Russia at the UN General Assembly session. Kamran Yusuf, Islamabad.
Under the title, the detention of fuel ships is a U.S. decision and our choice is Yemen's hurricane operations, thousands of Yemenis took to the streets of the capital Sana'a and other cities to protest against the Saudi blockade imposed on the country.
The Yemeni people today came out to send a message to the world that they will not sit idle against this stifling siege backed by the U.S. and enforced under the supervision of the U.K. and members of the Saudi-led coalition. The siege is aimed to bring the Yemenis to their knees.
The protests are taking place amid the worst fuel crisis in Yemen since the beginning of the war, as Saudi Arabia keeps seizing Yemeni oil vessels despite obtaining entry permits by the UN. The long lines of people queuing at fuel stations in the capital Sana'a have reached 4 kilometers for the first time.
The Saudi-led coalition continues to seize Yemeni oil ships amid the silence of the United Nations. Meanwhile, the UN Security Council overlooks the violations of Saudi Arabia and its allies. We call on the international community to look at Yemen as it does with Ukraine and to stand by the millions of Yemenis who have been suffering for 7 years.
Recently, Saudi Arabia tightened the siege it imposes on Yemen and led the war-torn country to a harsh fuel shortage. This has pushed the healthcare system to the verge of collapse, threatening the lives of millions of Yemenis, including children.
Protesters hold the U.S. responsible for supporting the Saudi detention of oil ships, saying Washington is a major partner in the war against their country. They believe that the Yemeni army operations against Emirati and Saudi territories, especially those against Aramco facilities, are the only way to lift the siege. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
In a historic and surprising decision, the European Union has decided to give refugees from war the instant right to live within the bloc and freely travel. They also have the right to work. They even now have rights to housing and medical care. There is one catch. This only applies to Ukrainians. These rights are not being extended to refugees from Palestine, Yemen, Syria, Libya, Afghanistan, Iraq, Mali, the Central African Republic, or any of the other countries in which Western armed interventions provoked refugee crises. Seemingly no one would begrudge Ukrainian refugees their human rights, but many in France are wondering why they are getting treated totally differently from black, brown, and Muslim asylum seekers.
Apparently you have to be white and Christian to be treated properly by the European Union. That's the sad reality, and it's totally unacceptable. We cannot discriminate according to religion, nationality or color, which are all things which we don't choose. What we can choose is to be human and to have solidarity with each other.
Drowning by the dozens in Calais, France. Freezing to death in Poland. Packed into camps in Italy, building steel fences, denying basic sanitation, fear-mongering about refugees election after election. The long-running European refugee crisis has taken a new turn, and yet standard European policy remains mostly unchanged. An outcry is growing for the European Union to extend their unity, and many say their humanity, towards non-white refugees.
We have to receive refugees and give them normal, humane conditions, regardless of what continent they come from. We have seen acts towards refugees on the Polish border, and we can't allow such things to happen in France. The government has to treat all refugees with total equality and with urgent measures like proper lodging.
Many say the open discrimination, which reveals a deep racism and xenophobia, as well as an arrogant hypocrisy, will ultimately stain the European Union around the world and at home. Many in the French media are describing Ukrainian refugees as somehow qualitatively superior to other asylum seekers. However, many hope that the European Union realizes soon that all refugees are equal and deserving of dignity, assistance, and the same rights without discrimination. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
When it comes to NATO support and American leadership, we have better ask Afghans. They have the experience of 20 years of Western forces presence in their country. Afghans had counted on Western powers at the beginning, but what the US and its allies really brought for Afghanistan?
Betrayal, definitely. The US and its allies' presence led our country to gallop backward. However, they failed in Afghanistan and ruined our country. We didn't gain anything from dealing with the West except destruction, poverty, and many, many crises.
Sayed Bakir Kazemi was an advisor to the former Afghan president Ashraf Ghani. He believes Ghani's government easily collapsed because he trusted the US and relied on NATO forces.
It is obvious and historically proven that any government or administration that trusted the US or relied on the West ended up with failure and downfall. This experience is repeated in many countries. Former Afghan President Ashraf Ghani did the same mistake and faced a bad downfall.
Some Afghan experts also blame crisis in Ukraine on the US, saying nations are falling victim to the US policies of creating war and terror.
The US is using Ukrainians for its own benefits. Western powers don't care about the collapse and destruction of a nation or government. They follow their own devil policies. Afghanistan's experience is repeating in Ukraine. I hope Ukrainians' leaders learn from Afghanistan's disaster and crisis ends in their country.
After 20 years of invasion, the US and its allies hastily abandoned Afghanistan in mid-August last year. Today, the country is dealing with the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Afghans are critical of US policies and its legacy on their soil. They consider trusting the US as a big mistake that no country should ever make it. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website www.parstoday.com www.vatican.org/en.
In the limelight.
Many countries have started relaxing rules and scaling back testing. Researchers are divided over whether this return to normality is too fast, too soon. Stay with us for an article in this regard written by Chris Stokel-Walker, writer. This article is published under the heading, COVID restrictions are lifting. What scientists think. Here's the story. Countries worldwide are starting to lift restrictions that were first imposed in 2020 to slow the spread of COVID-19, including rules that govern travel, socializing, mask wearing, and self-isolation. The changes are prompting mixed reactions from scientists. Bolstered by dropping infection rates and studies suggesting that COVID-19 caused by the Omicron variant of SARS-CoV-2 is less severe, politicians in places where that variant is dominant are relaxing rules that were introduced to tackle the pandemic. In the UK, for example, all legal restrictions related to COVID-19, including required masking in public and self-isolation following a positive test, are being scrapped. Other nations, including Poland, Slovakia, and Iceland, have removed the requirement to wear masks outdoors in public and relaxed rules on gatherings, including reopening restaurants and lifting capacity limits. Some researchers think things have been too quick to open up. In Switzerland, people no longer need to wear masks in most public places. And although those who test positive for COVID-19 must isolate for 5 days, all other restrictions have disappeared. Lifting the masks was premature, and I don't really understand why it was done, says Isabella Eckerl, co-head of the Geneva Center for Emerging Viral Diseases in Switzerland. She adds that polymerase chain reaction testing is returning positivity rates of more than 35% in the country, and only 7 in 10 people have at least one dose of a vaccine. The same proportion of UK adults have had 3 doses. Several countries that have dropped restrictions have been subsequent increases, not only in cases, but also in hospitalizations and deaths, although the link between cases and severe outcomes has decoupled, says DP Gerdasani, an epidemiologist at Queen Mary University of London. Although some deaths following a positive test are incidental, there is a very large proportion that are deaths due to COVID-19, she says. It's a very concerning situation, and that's not even talking about the impact of long COVID. D. Deepti Gurdasani, epidemiologist at Queen Mary University of London, would like to see the implementation of measures that can help to minimize the impact of relaxing restrictions on case and death numbers. For example, she says, if mask wearing is optional, there should be more focus on adequately ventilating buildings. But others think that high rates of immunity from recovery and vaccination in some places mean that many of the interventions designed to stymie the spread of COVID-19 are now moot. We are in a different place now, says Mog Sevik, who researches infectious diseases and medical virology at the University of St. Andrews. It's clear now we can't prevent infection, so the focus needs to be on preventing severe outcomes. She's optimistic that people won't start going crazy as soon as the rules on masks and socializing are relaxed. Instead, there will be a gradual shift back to normality. Joel Mosong, an infectious disease epidemiologist at Luxembourg's Health Directorate, supports lifting restrictions in his country. He says, we have seen some deaths, but nothing of the sort that we witnessed last winter, even last spring. The argument for keeping up the restrictions has really gone, and I think we are now in a phase where the strategy to remove restrictions is the right way to go. Alongside lifting restrictions, some governments are significantly scaling back their COVID-19 testing capabilities. Some researchers think this is a step too far at this stage of the pandemic. A reduction in routine testing will make it harder to identify flare-ups in infectiousness and to detect variants, says Eckrell. I will be a bit like finding the needle in the haystack. She warns, fewer restrictions and increased mingling among members of a population who have largely been separated could cause the SARS-CoV-2 virus to mutate, and testing could act as an early warning system should a variant of concern arise. Gurdasani thinks it is a mistake to remove contact tracing and testing, which the UK government plans to significantly scale back, including ending free testing for most people. Testing is vital, she says, so we can live as freely as possible. But not everyone is convinced of the need to keep larger-scale testing going. Sevik thinks the system should be more targeted. She says the benefits of general testing for asymptomatic people aren't commensurate with costs in terms of disruption to people's lives, but she thinks regular testing should remain in high-risk settings such as hospitals, care homes, and prisons. I think you have to have a good rationale for keeping up surveillance, says Mosong. More mutations will undoubtedly arise in the SARS-CoV-2 virus, and it will be important for governments to keep track of them. But that needn't involve recording every single individual case. What is important is not actually the testing, but what happens afterwards, he says.
Doing us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story. In
what is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Spotlight, I'm Kavitat Wade. There are no ambiguities about how the avalanche of sanctions against Russia is destroying the Russian economy. But what about the economy of European countries, or the U.S. for that matter? How about the rest of the world? Well, in this edition of the Spotlight, we will look at whether the economic warfare against Russia will make or break Russia first, or Europe and the U.S. perhaps, a gamble with the economic brunt ultimately falling on the ordinary people.
Since Russia attacked Ukraine on February 24th, Western countries have resorted to a host of restrictive economic measures to hinder Russia's ability to finance its military offensive in Ukraine. The U.S. and Europe, in particular, have imposed what they call unprecedented sanctions on Russia. They have frozen the assets of Russia's central bank, limiting its ability to access $630 billion of reserves. Likewise, planned investments in Russia have been restricted as a result of imposing capital controls. Moreover, several Russian banks have been removed from the SWIFT payment system to further isolate the country from the global financial system.
The sanctions has been triggered by the war, and the purpose is to weaken the Russian economy.
The sanctions have led to a sharp devaluation of the Russian currency, the ruble, and is pushing up the inflation. The crashing ruble is creating growing panic among Russian citizens and increasing the inflation. Europe is under pressure to broaden sanctions by targeting Russia's energy sector, but the continent imports about 25% of its oil and 40% of its gas from Russia, and the huge energy reliance has turned out to be a stumbling block. Gas prices in Europe soared to record highs on Monday on supply fears, reaching over $3,900 per 1,000 cubic meters for the first time in history. Sanctions on Russia are expected to further increase oil and gas prices, which will fuel inflation and intensify an already acute squeeze on living standards in Europe. Ending the war in Ukraine through pressurizing Putin is a priority for European leaders, but for now, they are weighing up how much pain they are prepared to inflict on their own people. Russia's economy is integrated into the global economy, and that means sanctions will hurt not only Russia, but the countries that impose such penalties. Sanctions are generally meant to bring about a policy shift or a change of leadership, but experience shows they fail to achieve those goals, despite bringing a lot of pain to the civilian populations. Whether Russia's efforts in the past years to make its economy sanctions-proof will pay off, or how the country will survive the tough sanctions regime it's facing, is anyone's guess. But the main question is, if the Western countries are prepared to go all the way and sanction Russian energy exports altogether.
Let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Joining us is John Ross. He's a senior fellow at the Chung Yang Institute for Financial Studies, who joins us from London. Also joining us, Paolo Raffone, Secretary General at the SIPPI Foundation, who joins us from Brussels.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. John Ross, I'm going to start with you. It must have looked very simple in some ways for the Russian President Vladimir Putin to have executed this military operation, given the military superiority of Russia and the Kremlin perhaps thinking that this operation is going to take a limited number of days, perhaps, or a short period of time. But at this point, we're looking at a gamble that Russia was hoping that if the duration was going to take a little bit long, that it could draw upon its war chest of about $630 billion. We can see that that has not transpired. Do you think that the Russian strategy in terms of its support is something that was either underestimated or not thoroughly thought through by the Russian president?
No, I think that the estimate of the situation of Russia is very simple. Russia was facing a deadly threat to itself. The incorporation of Ukraine into NATO would place NATO missiles, including nuclear missiles, about 5 minutes flying time from Moscow. And Russia made clear it was not prepared to accept this under any circumstances, in exactly the same way that the US in the Cuban Missile Crisis was prepared, if necessary, to go to nuclear war in order to prevent there being Soviet missiles within a few minutes flying time to Washington. That was the position of the Russia in this situation, the same as the US, and it struck against that. Then people totally misunderstand the history of Russia. Russia has been attacked four times. This is the fourth attack on Russia in the last two centuries, from the West, but from Napoleon in 1812, the Whites in 1918, Hitler in 1941, and each time Russia has defended itself and defeated the people who attack it. If you think it's going to be put off by the fact that Russian banks are taken out of SWIFT, or the Russian people are not capable of suffering that, they completely misunderstand Russian history.
Okay, we need to, but the history is not what is transpiring right now, today, looking at the different tools that Russia has in terms of trying to sustain sanctions. I talked about the war chest. I'd like to find out from you how Russia is estimating or forecasting at this point, from this point forward, how it's going to be able to maintain its military operation. Obviously, the sanction onslaught, which we're going to get into, is so severe. One of the consequences has been Russia's accessibility to its funds, which at this point, at least $460 billion worth, it can't access. This is for Paolo Raffone. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Paolo Raffone.
Yeah, evidently these the sanctions are unprecedented, also because they are targeting the central bank, which is one of the key organs of the identity of the state. So they are really unprecedented. So far, these kind of actions called sanctions were targeting commercial interests or individuals specifically. This time, they have been a leap forward. I do not see much of a problem for Russia because finally the reserves that Russia has, also in terms of gold and other assets, are sufficient to sustain the needs of Russia, even in the military endeavor that is carrying out. So there will be some problems, as we already know. There are some problems in the adjustment from an open world to a closed world, but they will keep going.
All right. Well, let's keep going and look at the broader world and look at the impacts that this has had, John Ross. The price of oil, it hit $140 a barrel. I mean, these are prices we haven't seen since the year 2008. We're looking at countries that are suffering from it, really worldwide. But in particular, in this case in point, we could talk about the U.S., or you can talk about the U.S. and also Europe, in terms of how it's impacting those economies. And we talked a little bit about the Russian perspective, but is this something that you think the Europeans and the U.S., which in some ways are leading perhaps this whole sanctions, did think that through? Was it in their calculations that oil would get to this price? And then what about a strategy for substituting it, which, again, we'll talk a little later as to some of the different routes they have taken?
No, I think they probably didn't calculate it would go to this price. I mean, I think it's destroyed the Biden presidency. I mean, he's already got inflation problems in the United States, and with the price of oil, I think he's finished. And therefore, the aggressive policy which the United States has carried out against Russia, because that's what's involved, the situation was totally clear. Russia was perfectly prepared to accept for Ukraine to be neutral. It was not prepared to accept for Ukraine to be part of NATO. Biden insisted on going ahead with the policy of NATO. He's now produced a war. He's produced a gigantic oil price, and he will lose the presidency as a result of this. So he's done himself in. Similarly, prospects will be, unroll themselves in Europe. But in the United States, it's totally clear that Biden has committed suicide by this aggression.
Some say, according to some polls, one poll, that Biden's presidency is going to be defined by this Ukraine war. Well, John Ross, Paolo Raffone, the U.S. Is suffering from economic fallout from this because we know that Russia is actually the third country on the list of the U.S. when it imports oil. Of course, we're looking at Europe also suffering from this. The price of oil has led, there was inflation, and now this is adding to the rise of inflation, which is at record levels, not only in the U.S., but also in Europe. So these shockwaves, is it sustainable for the U.S. and for Europe, let alone the rest of the world? For how long you think that this course can continue?
For Europe, there will be a serious problem very soon because the shortages, not only in energy supply, will hamper the small economic restart after the pandemic. So the situation will be, from a socioeconomic point of view, extremely tense, if not dangerous. And we will see it in the coming 3 months or so, because data that are coming in that basically, with the level of prices of today, most people will have just to either not heat themselves or stop their activities. So this is a situation that will backslash on Europe. And the awkward attempt to make the deal so that Iran could trade its oil because of the nuclear agreement is apparently in jeopardy at the moment, because the Americans have been pushing to a level that finally even the export of enriched uranium to Russia is not possible. So this is a sort of a cage 22 situation. Europe will have to rethink this aggressive sanctioning policy that has adopted.
Well, I'm not too sure if Europe is rethinking that, John Ross, when you're looking at, for example, how European gas prices are trading at MarketWatch said is equivalent of over $500 per barrel. You're in London. This is what's amazing, where bills are set, electric bills, energy bills, are set to hit £3,000 this year. That means 40 million UK citizens are heading for fuel poverty. So when our guest Paolo Raffone talks about Europe needs to think this through, well, people are going to, they don't have enough money to heat their homes. And we know in the UK, people die as a result of not being able to afford their electric bills or their gas or energy bills. Is this something the UK is taking into consideration?
No, but I think it will result in the fall of a large number of European governments, West European governments, because they've embarked upon a policy which is deeply damaging to their population. And in the contrast in Russia is that people will rally behind the government, because you don't understand Russian history. Russia, to defeat Hitler, suffered 27 million people dead. Undoubtedly, the Russian population will suffer as a result of the sanctions. But they're not, you know, it's nothing. I won't say it's trivial, but it's nothing compared to what Russia has been through in its history. Therefore, they will rally behind what the government is doing. Whereas in Western Europe, I would say, because of the result of the inflation, a large number of Western European governments will fall. And as I said, the Biden administration has committed suicide.
Okay. It's interesting. Paolo Raffone, what we're trying to do here is look at the Russian perspective and then look at the perspective from the Europeans and the U.S. And maybe we could put the rest of the world somewhat in that, minus, obviously, Russia's allies. It seems that the perspective from the European and the U.S. side is putting aside the interests of the people. And they're solely going after Putin. They want to bring Putin to its knees. The desire seems to be portrayed as such. Do you think that motivation is costing the Europeans and even the U.S., the well-being of their own citizens as a result of their sanctions regime?
Definitely it is, and it should be understood. So we are trying to understand who does what and why. So from the U.S. perspective, the challenge through military means that Russia has made is intolerable for the fact that it is putting an end to the hegemony that the United States have had since the end of Second World War in Europe, in the way that we have seen unfolded, especially in the past two or three decades. So this is something that for the United States sent all the strategists ballistic. And so they have now put in place this incredibly nonsensical aggression to a single person, which is Putin, and trying to unite the ranks in the West against this enemy that has been identified. Well, this is working in the short time now, but we have to see already in the medium time what will happen. And I doubt that democratic governments, which are inelastic to restrictions and shortages, will support this kind of policy.
Okay. Let's move on to another aspect of this, if we can, John Ross, and talk about the dollar, in which the U.S. has been very fond of using it in many different ways, and one in its foreign policy by weaponizing the effect and the use of the dollar. It's one of the tools in the U.S.'s toolbox. It seems to think that it could do that when it comes to Russia, through the sanctions policy especially. But many analysts are concluding that this may backfire, that the dollar is going to get threatened. One way that it's going to get threatened, and I'd like to ask from you, is how Russia has de-dollarized its economy for quite some time. And you add to that, for example, a major ally like China, who's been doing the same, not to mention Iran, who is also on that path. Do you think the dollar will be threatened as a result of the Ukrainian conflict and how it's progressing in that direction more and more?
Well, the position of the dollar will be weakened, but the dollar remains one of the strongest aspects of the United States. I do not anticipate that the dollar will collapse as the main means of international payment in the coming period. And therefore, this will create problems for Russia. Russia and China and Iran and other countries have definitely been attempting to de-dollarize. But this is a very difficult process, which will take maybe 10 or 20 years. So my estimate would be that the sanctions, including the dollar, will impose pain on the Russian population. I don't want to pretend that they won't. But the Russian population, because they conceive that they're defending their country, will be prepared to withstand this pain much more than the governments in the United States or Western Europe are capable of withstanding that pain. So I would like to say that the dollar will disappear, you know, as an international currency, you know, in the next 5 years, but I don't honestly believe it.
Well, this one particular viewer seems to think otherwise, Paolo Raffone, and I'm going to read off what he has posted. The decision to push almost 3 billion people from Russia, India, and China into trading with each other in currencies other than the dollar will go down as one of the most short-sighted and self-destructive policies in U.S. history. Do you agree?
To a certain extent, yes. It is evident that the building of this wall of sanctions and threats of military interventions, let's also think to Taiwan, it is something that is strengthening the links between all the rest of the world out of the West. So this is also something that we have seen, despite the majority vote in the General Assembly of the United Nations, the declarations of the single governments before the vote, they were quite interesting. I mean, they condemned the use of force, of course, because we are in the UN and it is the charter demanding it. But at the same time, there were a lot of nuances. So continuing this aggressive approach may risk to shift the majority of people who voted in the UN towards a new majority, which says we have enough of this aggressiveness of the United States, its dollar and its guns. So this may happen. And it is a gamble. We have to see what will be the evolution in the next days or weeks of the current warfare in Europe.
Okay. Well, since I'm looking at the clock, we really don't have that much time here. You've mentioned, John Ross, a number of times Russia's history here. And I'd like to also point out how the Russian President Vladimir Putin on many occasions has said that these nationalists or far-right Nazis, as he's called them, are using people as human shields. The history check that you gave us, the statements from Vladimir Putin, none of this is truly reflected in the media. Why is it that that side, the Russian side, is being neglected, at least to show, and I'm not promoting the civilian casualties caused as a result of this war, nor promoting war. Why isn't that side being, or that narrative at least, being covered in the way that it should?
Well, because the West has been carried on for 30 years a policy of aggression against Russia, that's the United States. The United States pretended that its only opposition to Russia was over communism, but once communism collapsed in 1991, the United States continued its aggression against Russia. So that shows that what the US policy was a total lie. So if you have 30 years of aggression against Russia, the truth of the situation is going to be concealed at the present time, and that's exactly what's happening.
30 seconds, Paolo Raffone. The threat of a third world war, nuclear proliferation, economic recessions possibly, in U.S. maybe, and Europe, and not to mention other parts of the world, the civilian casualties that have happened. Is that all worth it based on what has happened? Based on how...
This is really tragic what we are witnessing. I mean, it's something that wiser people like Kissinger or Kennan, who certainly knew the situation, they've been warning about in 2014 and after that. And the leaderships that have been coming to the United States, unfortunately, do not seem up to the task and have the knowledge enough to handle a situation which is dangerous if they push it too far.
Thank you very much. We're going to end it there. Paolo Raffone there, Secretary General of the SIPPI Foundation for Brussels. Thank you for your input. And thank you for your analysis, John Ross, Senior Fellow at the Chongyang Institute for Financial Studies from London. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. Newsroom@pacific.ir. Any questions or comments, that's our email address. You can send it to us. From Yikometagwe, entire team, it's goodbye. Until the next Spotlight.